Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your mottled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." Okay, and welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 9. This is going to be a totally new direction or a new phase in these talks. And this will be the first talk in the post-correction, post-March 19 in that sense. We're titling this the Navigating with the Wisdom Goddess. And the date today is July the 25th. We're in the hinge of Vajra Yogini. And today, John, go ahead and jump on the line there, and I welcome you to this talk number 9.
Thanks a lot, Thomas. It's great to be back with you, and we're forging ahead here, really. 9 talks, that's quite impressive, and
yes,
9 is a good number, too. So I'm very happy to be here and to commence this new series with you.
Absolutely. Now, there's really not much to mention here at the beginning, except for people who are not aware of the mailing list for the navigation crew that John has set up and has running since about 2 or 3 weeks ago. If you want to be placed on that mailing list, just give John a mail at navigator@metahistory.org, and he will gladly place you onto that. And John, today I want to go into this as kind of an orientation for the Gaian navigation experiment, so we can kind of clarify things for people and to give some verification to people who are already working with things. So I'm going to approach this today. I'm going to kind of just step back and just kind of hang on to your coattails, as it were, and jump in when I think I need to. And other than that, I'm just going to let you run with things. So please go ahead and take it away in your role as the main Turton.
Well, thank you, Thomas. That's very brave of you. You know, the coattails of the Nahual can be a slithery business.
Indeed.
But I'm sure you'll hang on very well. I would like to just use this first talk in the new series as an orientation to what I'm calling the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And those of you who've been on board so far will understand this, and let's go deeper with that idea, with that project. And for newcomers, I hope that this talk would serve as an orientation to what we're doing. So let me start out by talking about myself and what my role is as a navigator and the Turton of the Terma of Gaia Awakening, how I see myself and how I see what I can offer at this extraordinary, fantastic, momentous moment of our species history. First of all, I want to say what I don't do, and want you all to bear this very closely in mind. I don't predict. It's not the role of a Tertön to predict. A Tertön, traditionally in Tibetan, in Tantric Buddhism of Tibet, treasure finder, the Nyingma Tertöns, like Jingmi Lingpa and others, were working out of an ancient shamanic tradition of the Bon, or early indigenous pre-Buddhist culture of Tibet. And in that Bon religion, there were Dukpas, who were sky diviners and shamans. So basically, traditionally, I follow in this path. My role as a Tertön is to divine and read the sky. Everything that I will say, the term of Gaia Awakening came out of the sky. It was a mind treasure that I read in the sky. And everything that I say as navigator aboard the Good Mothership, I can verify it and back it up by reading off the sidereal code banks. So you can always count on me in that respect. I'm just not making things up off the cuff here. Also, I don't predict, as some people are doing these days, predicting what's going to happen to the Earth in the next 2 or 3 years. And some of them are invoking the name of Gaia and Sophia in doing so. Well, you won't find me in that category, and I don't hang out in those salons. I'm saying, sure, correction is an event underway. It's an astronomical event that began in March of 2011 and will more or less be completed in March of 2014. But that's not a prediction. It's more or less like we're on a ship and I'm saying to you, well, I've been talking to the captain, I've been looking at the navigation charts and looking at the ocean, and it looks like we'll round Cape Horn in March of 2014. You see, that's not a prediction, is it?
Yeah, it's an itinerary, and we don't know what will come up, you know, during that journey, what kind of storms we'll run into, what kind of winds, and on.
Precisely. It's just an itinerary. It's just saying as the journey is being charted, that's most likely when we'll come around Cape Horn. But what's going to happen on the way, what weather we're going to encounter, what other things, events may arise, I can't say, and I won't predict them. What I will do with my skill as a Tertön is that I will read these events as they unfold in real time. I won't tell you what's going to happen. I'll do something even better. I'll tell you, to the best of my ability, what is happening, which is much more interesting.
What is happening?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is what I'm doing in the crew notes. As you said, Thomas, anyone can receive these notes and try out the journey with us. So I'm charting the course that the planet, the mothership, is taking in general terms. And I am going to report on specific moments of the journey as we go along. But I'm not dictating any kind of plan. Wisdom Goddess does not have a plan. And anyone who tells you that she does, and they know what it is likely to be delusional. She does have, however, specific intentions for the human race, very specific intentions. And the fantastic thing for us now, the fantastic opportunity of this moment, is to actually know what the intentions of the Wisdom Goddess are as she directs them toward us, and to respond to her intentions. This is high, high interactivity. And it leads into high levels of planetary magic and echo sorcery. So this is a wild adventure we're taking on here. And the possibilities for each and every one of us to realize his or her potential as a magical being and as a creature of Gaia's imagination is absolutely limitless. So I'm really excited. I'm very pleased about the way things are going. I can't tell you the messages that I receive lately. Not a lot. It's not a question of quantity. But say 2 or 3 messages a day, sometimes 10 messages a week, among the many other messages I get. But 10 or 12 messages a week of the most beautiful confessions of the experiences people are having in the connection with the Wisdom Goddess. Beautiful testimonials. I'm really, really moved, and I want to thank everyone who's writing in to me in that respect. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit and give you a little preview about what's going to be revealed throughout the remainder of the course of this year in the Gaia Navigation Experiment. I've introduced this term, Divine Experiment, and I think I introduced it on our talks, didn't I, Thomas, right here on Grok the Talk in previous Planetary Tantra sessions?
Yes, indeed. I believe you actually used that term in our first interview we did on the Sophia myth before we even actually started the Planetary Tantra talks. It was at the end of that in the middle of January.
Indeed, and that is a most felicitous term, Divine Experiment. It is an orientation term. It is a superior NLP term. Because when you think in that framework, when you adopt that paradigm, we are in a divine experiment, then you put yourself in the mindset to discover what that experiment is. No one is going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm not going to dictate it to you and talk to you about some cosmic wisdom I received from another dimension. I'm with you in the process of discovering the terms of this experiment, and I may only be distinguished by the fact that I have certain skills in reading the cosmic, the sidereal databases, which help me to formulate what the experiment is. What's happening right now is that in the first stage of her correction, the Divine Sophia is reviewing and recovering in her own memory the original terms of the divine experiment that she proposed. This is what I call the premise of her experiment, which we are now fulfilling. She conceived this experiment when she was in the Pleroma before her plunge, and that was before the Archons arose, you understand, right? Because they only arose as a side effect of her plunge, right?
And this was before she had actually even made the decision to leave the Pleroma and join up or to come in closer contact with the Anthropos.
That's right. At this time, she didn't anticipate the conditions that she would actually be facing, but she did have a premise for the experiment, and she made a pact in her mind, in her imagination. She made a pact that she, as a goddess, would fulfill with one strain of the Anthropos when that strain emerged in a planetary world somewhere in the spiral arms. She did not, at the time that she conceived this experiment, that she preconceived it and daydreamed it on her own, she did not understand the conditions in which it would come about. And this is a fantastic thing to take on board. This is a fantastic, a radical and novel theological notion. Just gave a wonderful interview a night ago to Free Humanity Radio. I'm going to put the link in a mail to the crew list, which I pointed out that previous conceptions of God that we have, conceptions of God and theological conceptions that we have been taught and told through the ages, always make an assumption. If you ask any person to define God, they will pretty much say, whether they're a Hindu or a Christian or a Baptist, they will say, God is all-knowing and all-seeing. Well, I'm here to tell you that the gods of the Pleroma are not all-knowing. They are not omniscient. They are participants also in the great divine experiment, just like us. And there is novelty and unanticipated events in their worlds and in the world systems that they project. And so this is an entirely new concept of a deity that liberates us from the idea of omniscience, because the idea of omniscience is an oppressive idea, and it does not incorporate the novelty of the universe. On the contrary, it assumes that God can see the beginning, middle, and end of everything. Sophia could not see the middle or end of the adventure that she's in right now. She could only see the beginning.
Let me kind of slow you down there.
Sure.
Because that's a major, major concept to get your mind around. Because, as you say, we are conditioned to believe that God knows everything. Everything's predetermined in that sense. And you can't imagine a state of the universe that would be more boring, more dull than that. And when you can step into a different type of a paradigm where everything is novel, even for the aeons, even for the deities themselves, that things have, you know, an unexpected, unknowable flavor to them, that really changes your own worldview to a huge degree.
I think it does. I think it's tremendously liberating. And we are freed into the divine experiment, and we are freed into the realm of lila, or play. The play and dance of the gods is a free form, improvisational process. And so what you find in actual interactivity with a goddess will teach you many things and lead you to realize many things that are that you were never told and taught about God. So we are really at the verge of a tremendous liberation of human imagination here. So the goddess herself, in the first stage of her correction until the end of this year, will be recalling the initial terms of the experiment. And we ourselves are going to realize what they are as she herself recaptures them in real time. Now, I can't tell you right now what those terms are. I'm looking at them. I'm examining them. I'm following it very closely. And I'm looking with extreme care at those areas of the sidereal data banks that contain that memory, that hold the memories that she's going to retrieve. But what I will be able to say about it in September or October, I can't even anticipate right now. I can only recall as she recalls it and then render a description of that to the best of my ability. And I'm not the only one who's going to be recalling this. All of you who are attuned to the goddess now will be experiencing in your inner life, in your imagination, and in your psychic life, and in the artistic and poetic and creative side of your nature, you will be experiencing an upsurge of the imagery of her reactivated memory. So, and the fragments of it and the epiphanies of the goddess in recapitulation will actually be welling up within the human psyche. And we can all experience this together at the same time and follow this. And it's very, very exciting. So I want to give you two notions to follow with me, two notions so that you can track along with me the process that is now taking place in correction. And the language for those two notions is very simple: divine memory and divine alchemy. Correction is a process that works back and forth between divine memory and divine alchemy. The divine memory part is the recapitulation of the wisdom goddess herself. It's the part of the correction process where she comes to terms with her own reality and her situation, and where she realizes what she originally wanted in this experiment. She reestablishes her pact with the human species, and she comes to terms, she deals with it, she handles what has gone wrong with the experiment, and she's already doing this in ways that I believe can be verified. Yeah.
So is this recapitulation, is this basically, in a sense, another way to talk about coming into a lucid dream? Is that what started happening, say, 250 years ago? Are you putting those on this kind of the same time scale?
Yes, I would put them on the same time scale. About 250 years ago, okay, when she entered into her lucid dream, is when something happened that is extremely difficult for us to understand as ordinary beings. It's extremely difficult to understand in the first attention or in any linear or logical manner. In fact, it largely requires a kind of insider knowledge or expertise of an ahwal to understand what it means that she woke up in a lucid dream. She began to wake up in a lucid dream. But if I would give you my best shot and put it to you in the most cogent way I can, I would say this, that About 250 years ago, Sophia began to detect in her own consciousness what we call human history, the record of human history. And she started to follow the record of human history and, in a sense, to become involved in history. And it is by how she did this is something that you can only wonder about. You just have to wonder how this was possible. It's an amazing thing to investigate. But basically, as she began to turn her mind and her attention to what we, in our collective language, call the process of history, historical memory, she realized that history was a nightmare and that the human species was headed into a nightmare. And as I said before, around the time of the French Revolution, around the time of the terror, Gaia woke up into human history, and she woke up into a nightmare. And so her intention is to bring us out of that nightmare, to bring us through that nightmare and back to the premises of the divine experiment as she originally conceived it. And that is exactly what she's doing. And don't forget, my friends, she can do anything she wants. Anything. And all she has to do is intend it. If she intends the whole human species to go into extinction and rest in a larval state for 250,000 years, she can intend it in a New York second. And we are seeing now, with correction underway, we are seeing the power of the intention of the goddess directed upon the human psyche, collectively and individually. And I hope to be able to show you exactly how that is happening. It's already happening to you, and many of you are already feeling it. And you may not perhaps have the descriptive syntax to know exactly what it is, but that syntax can be provided. So on the one hand, by tracking the apogee of the moon and the way the apogee of the moon moves through the constellations, I track the process of divine memory. That will bring us back into her experiment and into the successful part of her experiment. And the rest of the nightmare of humanity, the fear-ridden, paranoid nightmare of domination and abuse, will fall away and dissolve like a bad dream, which is what it is.
And is that, in this sense, then that's not a natural thing that's going to cause that to fall away. This is through the deliberate intention of Gaia Sophia, that she, in a sense, is going to be taking on that aspect of what needs to be done. We don't need to, in a sense, initiate that.
We can't. It's beyond our... The nightmare has gone beyond... The nightmare of our own making is out of control. And it's a supernatural process that is going to correct this nightmare. A supernatural process. But the beauty of it is, it's not like the traditional salvationist scenario where we are the victims and God or the Messiah comes in and saves us from evil. It's a completely different scenario, and we do have the responsibility to follow this supernatural intervention and to participate in it and do our part. And believe me, we have a big part as well, and I'm going to get to that very soon.
Yeah.
Our part is called right action. Our part is called standing up to perpetrators. Our part is called taking out perpetrators, you know. So we've got plenty to do, and the preparations for that are well underway. But the beautiful thing is to realize that she's going to bring down this nightmare herself. That is her responsibility. And so we can track how she does that by decoding the sidereal data banks in the region of the lunar apogee. But then when we turn to the other side of the sky and we look at the region of the lunar perigee, and that is where the operations of divine alchemy come into play. Now, I haven't talked much about the lunar perigee so far, have I?
No.
No, not almost not at all, yes.
Well, I'm starting to talk now
about the lunar perigee. So just to clarify, we're going the two notions there of divine memory We've covered that a bit, and now we're going into the divine alchemy part of this with the perigee.
Right. Okay. I suggest that you use that as a mantra, and that you kind of stand and spread your feet apart and stand and kind of sway from one side to the other, like you're swaying on the deck of the mother ship. And as you sway from right to left, you say, divine alchemy, divine memory. Correction happens in the interweaving of divine alchemy and divine memory. So the processes of divine alchemy, I can give you the exact Nahual syntax for what they are. They are the, I call them bolts, B-O-L-T, bolts. A bolt, a jolt, call it a jolt if you want to. It is a jolt. You know, she's not called VV for nothing, you know? That name means flirtatious thunderbolt. And just as there are on this planet, physically speaking, at any moment, anywhere from 300 to 600 thunderstorms taking place, there are in the psyche of humanity now a number of massive thunderstorms taking place. And she strikes like thunder. And by reading and tracking the lunar perigee as it moves through the constellations, more or less opposite the apogee, I can tell you when these jolts happen. And I can also provide the descriptive syntax, because that is the role of the Nahual, the descriptive syntax to orient your NLP toward those events, so that you realize what she is doing when she jolts you, and that you know how to handle that. And it is my goal and my intention that some of us become masters of this process. That is planetary magic. And it is absolutely real and verifiable. I'm not talking about make-believe here, folks.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of sets the stage for what we're going to be doing and what I intend to do and what you and I will be discussing, Thomas, in these wonderful forthcoming series of interviews.
Very good. Now, how do you want to proceed from here, John? You have provided me with some notes, and I've provided you with some of my notes. Today, I want to kind of go along more with what you have sent on to me. Do you want to talk about the connection then into the myth of Andromeda?
Yeah, I would just like to point out that the first thing that I see when I track the lunar apogee, which is the index of her recapitulation, okay? The first thing that I see is that she has to recapitulate the original premises of our experiment. There's two things that the goddess must remember as she herself moves into correction.
Mm-hmm.
She never really forgot these things, by the way. It's just that they were relegated to sort of a back burner in her mind, you know, in her pleromic awareness. And that is because for a great part of Sophia's life as the planet Earth so far, she's been deeply absorbed in micromanaging the symbiosis of the planet and the weather and the oceans and all of these things. And this is a tremendous process. You know, it takes a lot of attention. You know, nothing,
sure,
I would point out to you, you might want to make a little meditation out of this. Go out and look at the wind. Go out and look at the trees. Look at the trees moving in the wind. Go out and sit by a brook and watch the water flowing. Go in the garden and look at the flowers grow. Look at all the processes of nature. How many are there? An infinite number that you cannot count. Well, none of that happens. None of that happens automatically. Do you think that happens automatically? You think that the zucchini that's growing out in my garden right now here in Spain just automatically comes out? No. Every single thing in nature, from the flight of a June bug to the migrations of flamingos in Africa to the Coriolis effect, is consciously sustained in real time by the aeonic presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in that sense, she's kind of busy with her first attention in just handling the day-to-day teeming hordes of life on this planet. You know, when you compare it to one of the archontic habitations, there's really not much happening on Mars or so on, you know, here on Earth and in her atmosphere and all of that contained. It's just a multitude, a countless multitude of activities that she has to pay attention to. And it even brought in the Christos intervention, you know, 580 million years ago. So she hasn't had time, in a sense, to go through the memories and recall things and so on.
She's been in a state of deep absorption with the life process of the Earth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, you hear the term immanence, divine immanence. It's a term in theology and in mysticism. Well, nature is a process of divine immanence. And the indwelling of the goddess in nature is a continual presence. She sustains everything in her dreaming. If her dreaming goes off for an instant, a species will go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been absorbed with that until now. But then about 250 years ago, her attention began to be drawn to the plight of the human species, kind of the pet species in her experiment, you could say. She realized that we had gotten off the track some time back, produced a nightmare for ourselves, and now she's turning her attention to us. And in that process, interactivity really ramps up to a very high level. So that's what is so extraordinary about this particular moment. Now, I'd like to point out that the importance of the Gaia story in everything that I'm saying. One way that you could describe what was taught in the mysteries in the past was that they taught the three S's: source, setting, and story. First of all, the mystery teachings of the pre-Christian world taught the source, that is to say, not only the source of the earth, but the source of the human species. There is absolutely no need, and I have to say this, you know, just out front, there is absolutely no need for anyone to be confused about where we come from, you know?
Yep.
The trouble with our species is we have been so deceived by the Abrahamic religions, and we have been so confused by the loss of indigenous wisdom that we reached the point where we people in the Western world think, well, I can kind of wonder where we came from, you know, where did the human species originate, but who knows? Nobody can ever know. No, we can ever really know. Well, that's a delusion. That's a complete delusion, and it's just an effect of our confusion. We can't actually know. And the answer is, of course, that the human genomic design was engineered in the galactic center. So we come from the galactic center as a species. We were not created by any advanced race that might happen to be inhabiting some planets in the galactic arms. And I have no doubt that there are all kinds of races and civilizations living in the galactic arms. There are countless numbers of them. Some of them are organic, some of them are inorganic species, some of them are mixtures of organic and inorganic species, but none of them, repeat, none of them originated the human species. So it's a fantastic thing to know where we come from. Source, and also to know that the source of the planet Earth is an aeon from the Pleroma. That's the first S. The second S that they taught us is setting. Look at the world we live in, planet Earth. The very setting that we live in is the same as the source. That is a fantastic proposition.
Yeah, that's
that
true.
Is,
yeah,
that
is
true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
That'll knock your socks off when you really
let
that sink in.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unique. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't any other planetary system anywhere in the canomic dimension, that is the spiral arms, that might have those similar conditions. There may well be, but All I know is that that is the case for our world, and that it can be explored and verified that that is so. Finally, we come to the third S, which is the story. Remember we were talking not too long ago, Thomas, I think the last time we talked, and I said, it looks like PT goes fractal in June of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yes.
That term, PT goes fractal, is an intentional language. It's intended to teach something and intended to instill a certain truth. You know, there are people that are talking about Sophia a lot these days. People are claiming to know what the goddess is doing, claiming to have some kind of cosmic wisdom that they received from some galactic dimension, going out of the body or something like that. People mm-hmm. are even using the term Gaia Sophia. They're talking about the Christos. And that's all fine with me. I have no objection to that. People are picking up parts of this story. But what I want to emphasize is that the story doesn't go in parts. So if someone is citing Sophia and talking about Sophia and making an allusion to the Archons, don't assume from that they are transmitting the Telestic myth of the mysteries. Because the only way to transmit the Telestic myth of the mysteries is in its entirety. When I say PT goes fractal, I mean that each person who carries this story observes and respects the entire story arc, the mm-hmm. nine episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, a fractal, a holographic plate is fractal. If you have an image of an apple tree on a holographic plate and you break that plate into 1,000 fragments, each fragment will contain the image of the entire apple tree.
Yes.
Just on each fragment
a lower
does
level
not
of,
contain
of frequency.
Of frequency.
Yeah. Right. Each fragment does not contain a part of the image of the apple tree. It's not
right.
like a jigsaw
right.
puzzle. The Sophia mythos, the Sophianic vision story, mark my words, is not like a jigsaw puzzle. So if anybody's going around holding up a piece of it like it was a jigsaw puzzle, they're not transmitting the myth because it's only transmitted fractally. If you carry it, you carry it in its full integrity intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they say, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than a half truth, you know, or a partial truth.
Well, it's not really dangerous what these people are doing. It's just a distraction, and it will fall mm-hmm. apart. It won't hold together. You can't pick out a snippet from the Sophia mythos, like Sophia and the Archons, and make some arbitrary make-believe comment about it that you think sounds interesting. Or claim that you were inspired by some extra, you know, some galactic beings who told you A, B, and C, it's just going to fall apart. It's going to look absurd, and it won't last.
Mm-hmm.
The power of this myth that directs our species toward its correct role in the cosmos and brings us back into alignment with the Pleroma and brings us into the wonder and mystery of the divine experiment is in the integrity of the plot structure. The structure is a powerful syntactical directive tool. So please observe, if you want to be part of this story, bear in mind that you observe the entire story and you respect it as it's told. Then we're going to elaborate it, we're going to expand it, we're going to fill in missing episodes, like you mentioned, Thomas. It's really important for us very soon to understand about the moon.
The moon, yes.
Yeah. The moon is a big missing element of the Sophia story. If you look at the nine episodes that I've restored, you'll see that I don't that nine episode outline doesn't include a description of how the moon was created, how the moon came into being, or why. In fact, I'm of the understanding from the part of the mythology that I'm currently recovering that the moon is older than the Earth, and that it did exist and come into existence before the material body of the Earth, which is an amazing thing. There's a lot. There appears to be a lot of evidence that supports that.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the same time, I want to point out that the claim that some people are making that the moon is an artificial satellite that was constructed by ETs and placed around the Earth in order to be a monitoring signal system to keep us in a mind control trance, you know, is absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. And I can tell you from direct experience, and I think Thomas would be one of the first people to stand with me on this, that firsthand experience of the actual frequencies connected with the lunar cycles is the most liberating instruction that you will ever receive.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because, well, when you said that, I just got chills going up my legs there because it really is the absolute difference between each month or each cycle. Once you connect into it, it's astounding. I don't know, John, is that something that's always been in our psyche, but just connecting to planetary tantra and making it conscious, then I guess you kind of become more aware of it on a conscious level. But it stands out in your mind, in your life. Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful, palpable thing.
Yes, the frequencies, the Dakini frequencies that can be tracked by the lunar cycles are a source of divine instruction, sacred instruction, a source of magic, empowerment, and liberation. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the mind programming agenda that is unfolding on this planet. The mind programming agenda on this planet is strictly of human origin, strictly. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so to put it off on the moon and to claim that the moon is, now what are we going to be? It's another fear-mongering bullshit, and I'm really tired of it.
Sure.
You know? Now we're going to be afraid of the moon, right?
Yeah.
Let's be afraid. What is it next we're going to be afraid of? You know, skunks? Oh, let's be afraid of skunks, you know?
Yeah.
So to answer your question,
I want to just throw this in here before you continue with that thought. It's just, it sounds like you could just, for people who have not paid attention to the moon and to the cycles and things in their life up to now, you say, well, I can just disregard the moon. I don't need to pay attention to it, and so I don't need to be afraid of it. But it doesn't really work that way because, you know, these things that are being put out there by some so-called researchers, that does get into your consciousness. And if you don't deal with it, it will affect how you respond to those frequencies or to those cycles. So it is something you need to have a intellectual grasp on as well. So please, John, go ahead and continue on with that, though.
Certainly. One of the things we need to understand about our species is our vulnerability to deception. And part of that is due to suggestibility. We're a highly suggestible species. And so it's merely enough for certain people to say something like that the moon is an artificial satellite, you know, engineered by ETs, and it's part of a massive mind control problem, and, you know, it's so huge and so big. And they never say anything about our power, about our magic, about our ability to control our own minds. What about our ability to control the minds of the Archons? Is anybody talking about that?
Yeah.
No. They're just talking about the Archons and their ability, their influence on us. They're overwhelming us with their mind control devices. Well, I can tell you, and turn that right around and set it on its ass very, very fast. And that's what we're going to do in these upcoming talks. Because I'm not only going to present the navigational, the navigational steps of the navigational journey, but also some practices for working against these archonic powers. And it is possible now to employ these practices because the wisdom goddess herself is boosting our ability. One of the jolts, one of the hits that she's made 5 hits on the human psyche since March 19th. 5 massive hits. And one of these
times of the surges.
Yeah, at the times of the surges. And one of these hits, which was in July 7th, which was a lunar perigee surge, was a massive hit upon the thymus region of the body, which is the upper chest, and of the immunological system. And what this, the intention of this hit that she made is to absolutely boost our immunity to archonic influences. And that refers both to the supernatural aspect or the intrapsychic paranormal aspect of the archons, and I can explain exactly how they get to us and how to resist that, but also equally so to the archonified human beings, the perpetrators and the psychopaths who are spreading fear and who want to control and manipulate everyone. She has boosted our immunity to that to an enormous degree with this hit that she made on July 7th. So we are in a position where we are becoming, if you will, empowered. But bear in mind that John Lash uses the word empowerment very cautiously. I don't like the word empowerment. It has too much of a narcissistic and New Age spin to it.
Yeah, the secret and all that stuff, yeah.
Right. So I suggested years ago that the true word to use is not empowerment, but consecration.
If you look at the word consecration.
If you look at the word consecration, it consists of two parts. Con meaning with, and sacration from the root sakar or shakti meaning power. So concentration means having power with. So the true empowerment is not some narcissistic glorification of you and your ego and your world and your reality and your wishes and blah, 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 you know. The true empowerment on this planet is consecration. It's having power with the goddess and with each other, among ourselves, a shared power, a power-sharing arrangement. I've often said this is what planetary tantra is. It's a power-sharing pact with Gaia Sophia. And we are really now in a process where this power-sharing pact is getting amped and vamped really to a high, high level. And as I speak, the mothership is revving her engines.
That is wonderful. I love that. So consecration. So get that into your syntax there, into your vocabulary. Very nice.
So let's see. We're at about 45 minutes now, Thomas. And so shall I kind of wind up this in the next 15 minutes, wind this up, and then we will do the second part of this introduction in a day or so.
Yes. Before we do the winding up of things, just to go back to the moon for 1 second. So what you're saying is that the creation of the moon will come out in real time, sometime as this, you know, the next 2.5-3 years progresses.
Yeah, sooner rather than later. When she remembers it, and she's going to remember it. She's remembering it. I think it's going to come up in the early part of her recapitulation. And because one of the big things that Gaia will be remembering as she does her recapitulation is her confrontation with the Archons. Now, as you know, if you've read my interpretations of Nag Hammadi and other things on the website, and I would advise that people go back to MetaHistory.org, click on the site guide, go to Gnostic, go to the Archon Files, and there's 3 essays that go together in the Archon Files, and they're called The Promise of a Lonely Planet. And the first one in that series, The Promise of a Lonely Planet, is, I'm bringing it up right now, is called Starbirth and Simulation. And The Promise of a Lonely Planet are those 3 essays which have a tremendous amount to say about her encounter with the Archons and how the Archons came to be and what we are facing as we face the danger of the Archons and how it endangers the divine experiment. And she's going to be reviewing all that. And so what we're due to learn in real time, as she remembers, is we're due to not only get a recapitulation or a review of that moment, but even to see more deeply and profoundly into that moment and to see the engagement and the opportunity of that moment. So her recapitulation is not just a nostalgic, you know, it's not just a walk down memory lane here we're talking about.
Sure.
We're talking about a powerful act of an aeon recalling and reliving in her imagination certain events in her story. We relive those events with her, And in the process of doing so, we enter into the consecration of her powers. The consecration of her powers is her gift to us. And this is how we now live into that gift. It's a fantastic opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That's very clear.
So I also want to point out that,
let's see,
in closing, what can I pick up here?
I asked you about Andromeda. Now, do you want to put that at a later time?
Yeah, the Andromeda thing, as I said, I've discussed it in the crew notes number 3, mm-hmm. are dedicated to that. Now, I'll give you just a 2-minute synopsis.
Okay.
Whenever there is, there's a famous theme or motif in the Gnostic materials, the Gnostic cosmological writings, such as the Apocryphon of John, the Hypostasis of the Archons, On the Origin of the World, these are the Gnostic cosmological texts. You can find them analyzed in depth on medhistory.org. And one of the key themes, one of the most important themes that we encounter in these texts is the theme of singular dreaming. Now, we are told, and this comes from a line in the Gnostic text called a Valentinian Exposition, a very famous line where it says, "It is the will of the originator that no event should occur in the Pleroma except by a syzygy or coupling." This is an absolutely fantastically profound statement of cosmic law, if you will. The originator is the monad, or the basis of all the aeons, and the aeons are the generators. Why do we have to have an originator and generators? Well, because the originator is so generous that it never does anything itself. It just gives away its power.
It just gives and gives, yeah.
By the way, I'd like to point out, on the basis of my first-hand shamanic experience, that the primary quality of an aeon, to be in the presence of an aeon, the aeon Sophia, the primary quality you feel is not love, it's generosity. Generosity is the supreme divine quality. And the originator is so generous that it doesn't even want to do anything itself. So it allows its infinite potential to surge into these other aeonic entities called generators. And they are the ones who actually produce the experiments of the myriad worlds. But the Gnostic cosmology tells us that the originator has a preference, okay? The preference is, well, I would like the generators who take up the infinite potential that I offer them, I would like them to work in pairs when they produce their divine experiments. That's my preference.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, freedom, absolute freedom, inconceivable freedom, is also a quality of the aeons. And so the originator doesn't impose that rule. And we learn in the story of Sophia that she was an exception to that rule, wasn't
mm-hmm.
she? She dreamt up the experiment with us all by herself. It was what is called a singular dreaming. And so we are involved in a unique and anomalous situation of a singular dreaming. However, I would point out that the originator, don't know what word to use, clever is a cheap word, the originator is extremely magical.
Mm-hmm.
And so the originator itself, not he or she, this is the Godhead, folks, this is the ultimate of ultimates. The originator mm-hmm. allows the rule of divine coupling to be disregarded, as occurs in the case of Sophia. But at the same time, the originator always provides for the rule to be observed at the same time. Wow, how can that happen? That's really interesting. I mean, that's a paradox. You mean, here's the mm-hmm. cosmic, every divine experiment originating in a galactic core ought to be emanated by a pair of aeons. But they're free to do whatever they want. So if a single aeon wants to generate an experiment, they can. Yet, at the same time, there is always the principle of coupling is always observed. Well, how can that be? That happens because the originator always produces a control group for every experiment. Therefore, every experiment is double, even when it's single.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And so our experiment here on Earth has a control group, and that is the Andromedan counterpart to our experiment. So in the Andromedan galaxy, circulating a sun, a star in that galaxy, on an Earth-like planet that resembles the Earth, are the doubles, the Andromedan doubles, of every single person who lives or who has ever lived on this planet. And they are living coexistent and simultaneous with us right now. And in Andromeda, on Andromeda, it's the control group of an experiment. Nothing happens to the control group, as you know. So on Andromeda, they don't go into the human nightmare. They retain and they live out and they preserve the perfect fulfillment of the divine singular experiment. And they also retain the memory of that experiment from its origin. So this is why it's so important to realize that through the Andromeda myth, we are going to be rediscovering the pact, the terms of our experiment with Divine Sophia and the pact she made with humanity. And in the right now and in the immediate future, I am decoding this myth of Andromeda. It has never, ever been properly decoded from the Andromeda.
When you say the myth of Andromeda, you're talking about the Greek myth.
That's right. We have in received form a Greek myth that says there was this princess called Andromeda, and for one reason or another, she was chained to a rock and condemned to be eaten by a monster called Cetus, who represents the Ahrimanic or Archonic powers, and that the hero Perseus rescued her. How did he do so? Well, he got the cloak of invisibility from Hermes. He got wings that allowed him to propel himself. And he also cut the head off a monster called the Medusa.
Yes.
And by using the head of this monster, which was had hair of snakes, he held up this monster, and it paralyzed the Cetus monster, and he was able to kill Cetus and thereby save Andromeda. This is the received form of the Greek myth. But that's not how the Andromedans tell it. So what we are due to learn now, very soon, is how this myth is actually told from the Andromedan point of view. And then it becomes actually the story of Gaia herself. In fact, the hero of this story, Perseus, is really Kali. It's really, the hero is really a woman. The hero is really Kali, the wrathful form of Gaia. So when we turn the received Greek form of the myth inside out, we get to the memory of the goddess and the memory of her original pact with our species and how she's going to rescue us from the Cetus monster, which is the nightmare of the dominator pathology that's eating off the planet.
Very interesting. Cetus is kind of the symbolic or the metaphorical representation of the archontic forces themselves.
That's right. And Cetus is a vast constellation that lays sprawls beneath the fishes and the ram. And so while the apogee of the moon is shifting through the fishes, it's also shifting along the body of the constellation of Cetus. And I can track that shift star by star. And each star is a data bank that contains a certain memories of this myth. So by reading the star, you unlock the data bank, you get that part of the memory, and that's how I put the myth together.
Well, the Andromeda myth and the concept of a control group in another galaxy, that's an amazing concept, and it's something that will probably take quite a few listenings and quite a few recollections to try to seed into your consciousness. But it's a fascinating idea.
It's possible, Thomas, and I'm sure that's the case. Some of you will want to contemplate this myth and reflect on it very deeply. And might I advise, enjoy enjoy it as you do so, you know?
Yeah.
How fantastic it is that we have the true principles and laws of cosmic life encoded in these myths and their story mm-hmm. forms. So mm-hmm. we're a species who loves stories, you know? We're a storytelling species. So we not only get to drink deeply upon the knowledge and sacred instruction of the universe, but we get to do so in a story that we really can enjoy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, I want to point out that the epiphany of the memory of the goddess now, as I mentioned at the beginning, is surging up in the minds and imaginations of many people. So I suspect that there will be some people that the first time they hear the idea of the control group on Andromeda and the Andromeda doubles preserving the memory of the perfect achievement of our experiment will click into it instantly. Instantly.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Boy, now, John, I just want to throw one thing by you in the last couple minute or so before
sure.
we sign off for today. So the Godhead or the monad's preference is that the creation is done by the aeons and dyads. So now that Sophia is doing this in a singular fashion, in a singular dreaming, would it be an incorrect way to look at this as thinking that maybe she is performing a dyad with us and trying to create in that fashion instead of with another aeon, with Christos or whatever way you want to put that, but she's creating a dyad with us. Would that make sense in this context?
I would say that makes a lot of sense, Don.
Okay.
I would say that's a lovely approach to what's happening.
Okay, yeah, that kind of popped into my head a couple days ago, so very good. Well, John, let's see, we've got a good 8 or 9 pages of notes, and we're just kind of in the first couple, 2 or 3 here, so let's continue this in about 48 hours from now.
Super. We can pick it up with the Archons and talk about how she is handling the Archons, and she is indeed. And I would like, if you remind me, Thomas, I would like to point out current events in the world that would be a reflection of her hit on the Archons, because she's taking the Archons down big time.
Okay.
And she has to, because we can't, in fact. The situation is out of control in insanity and absurdity. And no one should expect of themselves that they could do that. So I'd like to start on that note, because it's so inspiring and absolutely startling to see what she's doing.
Fantastic. Okay, that's noted, and that's where we'll start talk number 10 then. And I want to thank you again for today, and just to speak on behalf of everyone who's contacted me, and I'm sure the people who have contacted you as well, that I'm very thankful for you to bring this incredible practice, this incredible teaching into the psyche, into the world. And I just want to say a deep appreciation to you for what you've done. And with that, let's go ahead and sign things off for today, John. And I will talk to you in 2 days.
Okay, agreed. Thank you so much, Tom.
All right. You bet.